This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Soldanela. I am with the amazing Melissa Rendler Garcia. I'm a bit out of words what to say about this great lady, but I bring her, I wanted to speak to her because she is a consummate professional, a world traveler, and someone that really has been looking at public health from different perspectives in different areas of health care. Am I right? Mm-hmm. And I love that about you. And I kid you not when I say she has traveled far and wide to bring news, to advocate, to help the people that are advocating for, among other things, cancer around the globe. And it's an issue close to the heart of many, many people. And I think she has a lot to say. And I kind of want to go through a little journey of her career. And she can just talk. Because, you know, a young showgirl. I'm putting her, you know, she is a very serious person. But there's something about her that's bubbly. Everybody just loves her. I love you.
Oh, I love you too, Sol.
So,
and with that introduction, I don't know. I think I should just should end it right there.
No, we
ended right there.
We have so much to talk about. No, but seriously, I want people to know why you love public health.
Why I love public health. Well, first, thanks so much for inviting me on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I love every single episode that you do. I learned something new and incredible from all the wonderful people that you have on and all those conversations. I think that you bring something really special to the world of arts and culture. And news and information that's so important and has been missing for a long time. So as a listener and as a fan, I really appreciate that. So that's my first thing I want to say.
Thank you, my dear.
So how I started, it was mostly because I think just my background growing up, I was an affirmative action baby. I grew up in Little Havana with, you know, in a very tight-knit Cuban community. Within a context in that time, the 80s and the 70s, where a lot of things were changing, a lot of politics, you know, both nationally and internationally, not just what was happening in Cuba, but what was happening within the states and the Latino population, you know, really affected me. And I was very lucky that I had always been a very good student, and I loved to go to school, and I spent more time at school than I did at home. And because of that, I was awarded a scholarship to go away to a very fancy, prestigious girls' boarding school in Connecticut. And I give a lot of credit to my mom for letting me go, because it was, you can imagine, growing up in a Latino household, you know, little girls don't leave home, especially at 14. And my mom really fought for me. And she said, you know, I know that this will be your best opportunity in life if I can give you this. And in a lot of ways, I was very grateful to the boarding school that I went to. They paid full scholarship and I was allowed to go. But, you know, to go from Little Havana to very Anglo Connecticut was a culture shock that I had never, ever imagined that I would ever see, even though, you know, my father is American from Wisconsin, very American, but my parents divorced when I was very young. I grew up with my Latino, the Cuban community, so it was kind of like the first kind of experience that I had outside of that world, and it was so different. And one of the first things that I saw was that really shook me to the core and shocked me. Viscerally was just the wealth that you see in Connecticut and how beautiful the school was and the surroundings, and the school had even in its own stables, you know, girls would come with their horses and they spoke such crisp, beautiful English. I had never heard anything like this. And I remember the first time I drove up to the campus when I was coming from the taxi from the airport, I see these girls playing field hockey in skirts, and I'm like, that's crazy. They're playing sports in skirts. I'd never seen anything like that. I had never seen field hockey before. I had never seen snow. And I was always a very good student, but by the time that I got there, I was really behind, so it took me a while. But what really got to me was that, You know, I saw how hard my family struggled. I saw how hard my mom had struggled to be able to provide for me and try to give me the best thing possible. And it was just no comparison. So I saw what inequality was very front and center. And, you know, the effects of race, ethnicity, and class had on me and other girls like me. I was a scholarship student, and I actually, you know, I got, I was more friends with a lot of my teachers and a lot of my peers because I could relate to them. They were more working middle class. So I think from there, too, I realized how important and how grateful I was to have had that opportunity to go to school. But it also showed me that I had been given that opportunity and that I wanted to be able to do something to help others because I knew I couldn't waste it. So I think from there, my views about, you know, social change and wanting to help others really was cemented right there. And from there, I went to Sarah Lawrence with you, my freshman roommate. And I think I became more emboldened, and I knew that one of the other things that boarding school taught me was that the world is very big. You know, when you grow up in a barrio, you know, when you grow up in a very tight community, lower economic situation, you know, your world is very tiny, right? Your surroundings are very limited, and a lot of times a lot of kids don't get that opportunity to understand or even see anything that's even within their city, let alone in their state or in other parts of the world. And going away at that time at 15 really opened my eyes to that, you know, how important it is to be able to go see, do, be with other people, because it changes you. It changes you radically, right? The way that you see the world and the way that you interact. So from there, I just wanted to travel. I wanted to, you know, I was a big fan of, you know, Madeleine Albright and all these wonderful women that worked in the international community. And I wanted to do something like that. I wanted to work for the UN. I said I wanted to work in a refugee camp. That was my dream. I don't know how I was going to do it, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work internationally. I wanted to focus with primarily on Latinos, but I wanted to travel as much as I could. So I went to college, went to grad school. I got a master's in public affairs from LBJ, and I tried as hard as I could everywhere I went to at least travel somewhere, to find scholarships to go wherever. Before I started college, I got another scholarship, and I took a year out, and I moved to England because I really wanted to go to Europe, and it was the only way for me to go. So I said, I'll go however. And, you know, it was the first time in Europe, and, you know, it was fantastic. So I got to Sarah Lawrence knowing that I was a traveler, and I love to be able to find a way to observe, to learn, to fit into cultures that weren't my own. And it was fascinating to me, too, to see how people reacted to me. So when I went to England, for example, it was at the time where Miami Vice was very popular. And when the girls in my school would learn that I was from Miami, they're like, oh, is it like Miami Vice? And I'm like, well, no, not really. Or I would be in the dorm and I would play salsa music. And I'm like, what is that? We like it, but we've never heard anything like that before. So it was just fascinating to me to be able to observe them and them observing me. So I went to England, and then I went to Sarah Lawrence and grad school. And in grad school, I really realized that I wanted to be able to do more humanitarian aid. So my focus at first was humanitarian. I wanted to work for the UN, like I said. Work for, you know, the UN Agency for Refugees, which is also a special part for me because, you know, when you come from immigrant families, right, you understand what it's like to be able to, how hard it is to be able to adjust to a new life, a new world, a new city, for anybody, let alone a child or an elderly person. So that was always my focus. But after I finished grad school, I kind of hit a roadblock, or I had one of my first challenges was that, you know, to be able to go away and work for the UN, a lot of times what people would do is just basically hit a country, go to a country and volunteer, and then they would hire you because, you know, it's a very hard, you know, getting jobs in the United Nations, especially as an American citizen, is very difficult if you don't have a lot of skills, especially as a young person. And I just didn't have the money or the opportunity to be able to do that. I had all these skills. I had a grad degree. I finished graduate school very young. I was 23, 24, straight out of college. I was overeducated and underqualified, and which happens to a lot of people. But I realized that there was no way that I was going to be able to go to a country and live on my own and intern, right? I needed to work. There was no way. So I kind of retraced my steps and made my own strategy, and I moved back to Miami. I worked for a very large social service agency for a little while, working with immigrants who were coming in, newly arrived, populations that, you know, really did need a lot of help adjusting. I had a great boss, but I realized that I still really wanted to work internationally, even though I loved social service, I loved working in Little Havana, I loved being home. So I decided to join the Peace Corps. So that, like a lot of other people, a lot of times it's the best way to start an international career. So I joined the Peace Corps, and I decided to go to some place that I had never really explored before, which was Eastern Europe. I lived and worked in Romania for 2 years. I learned Romanian. And Romania was very interesting because, you know, at that time, Romania was really in the news because of the problems, you know, after the Ceausescu was overthrown, and they saw a lot of the problems in the social network, the social community, the social fabric of Romania was just very, very intense. And there was a massive problem at one point with a lot of the orphans. You know, there was a very large orphan population in Romania at the time. And it was a cultural custom that they would give newborns blood transfusions, right? And so at the time when AIDS was already kind of exploding, in particular in Eastern Europe, you know, we had whole swaths of very large populations of or Romanian orphan children that were exposed to HIV. And that profoundly affected me. I went to Romania and I worked as a consultant for NGOs, for non-governmental organizations, startups. These are folks in one town in a very, very poor area of Romania on the border of Ukraine. And it was, for me, a really exciting time because these are organizations that were new in an environment that was a completely new environment to them. You know, when you can imagine when you live for so many years under such a brutal dictatorship, you know, and then to open and to try to work within a larger democratic community and all the things that you have to learn to be able to do social service. And there was so much need from, you know, obviously those who worked with orphans or the elderly population or different populations that really were in need. They needed a lot of training. So I was really happy to do that. And I learned Romanian and I would work with the municipal government. I would work with small nonprofits. I would work with different charities. I would work with nonprofits, particularly that worked with orphans, to try to teach them how to start their own, basically, nonprofit, right? Everything from, you know, how you write a proposal to get funding, how you do press releases, how you work with the media, how you do fundraising. And it, you know, really changed my life. It's very hard to be able to work in a community that's not your own, but it was interesting because Romanian is a Latin language, so they speak, you know, it was not as difficult for me to learn Romanian, and they are very, even though they are Eastern European or and very Slavic as well, but they are still very Latin. So the first 3 months of my training, you know, you live with a family. And I lived with this little family where the parents worked at a car factory and the three kids in a very small apartment. They gave me, you know, the living room to live in. And when I found out how old the mom was, it really shocked me because she was in her mid-40s, like us now, and looked 20 years older, you know, because life was just very, very hard. But it was such a privilege for them to have me. But the first night I was there, you know, their prized possession was the TV, and they invite me into the parents' room to watch their favorite show, which was Esmeralda. So I was like, well, I don't go that far. But I just thought that was so great because it's like, you know, that was the telenovela that my grandmother was watching at the time, and it was even popular in Romania. So, you know, the world isn't as separate as you would think, right? But it's really an eye opener because life is hard when you live in a community and when you have a family that, you know, kind of struggles to make ends meet, as my family had done. But when you see what other people had to go through for so many years and what they had to do to be able to just put food on the table for their kids, it's really a humbling experience. So I was in Romania for 2 years. I did that. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to travel. I wanted to continue work internationally. And so when I got back, I explored jobs after I finished my stint in the Peace Corps. And I got my first job with a very large nonprofit that works internationally, kind of like CARE, but that worked in public health. And I hadn't, at that point, I'd always worked in social service, you know, nonprofits always, with some health element, but this was very, very focused on public health. And I love what they did. They were social marketers, and they worked in trying to help change behaviors and trying to help improve specific public health issues that really affected the low and middle income countries. So they focus mostly on HIV/AIDS prevention, maternal child health, malaria, the big issues that really affect people around the world. But I love the fact that these, and the way that they did it was that they would do communications campaigns, but also promote the use of products, right? And the idea was that they would sell products at a very cheap price, right? So to be able to encourage populations to use them. So in that case, for HIV/AIDS was mostly condoms. So I love the fact that they were condom social marketers. I learned a lot about, you know, safe sex and what it takes to sell condoms and how you promote them. And so it was just fascinating. And I worked with a brilliant group of people that came from a lot of different places. All of them had the same denominator, that they were very smart and were easily adaptable, but a lot of them came from the private sector and they wanted to come. So I worked with a lot of people that had worked for Johnson & Johnson and, you know, a lot of big PR companies and a lot of big marketing companies, but they decided to change jobs. So it was great. So you had a mix of private sector and that sort of mind frame, and also public sector people that were really always eternal do-gooders like me, right? Because I wasn't a private sector person. So that's how I started. And I started in D.C. And then the way that it worked is that you had to do your time in the head office. I did that. And then, you know, then you could go away and go to one of those programs and go to one of the country offices. So I decided that I wanted to go somewhere as remote as possible. So I decided that I wanted to, and they offered me the job of running a very small, very interesting program in the middle of the Amazon, the Bolivian Amazon, on the border between Bolivia and Brazil, trying to reduce malaria by selling mosquito nets and doing communication campaigns about how important it was to use a mosquito net. And so I ran an office of about 20 people in 3 different locations in one of the most remote parts of the world, so remote that they wouldn't even send Peace Corps volunteers there, so it was funny. And there were some foreigners there, but that was also a life-changing experience for me. And I was very young, so, you know, 27, 28, in charge of a very large budget. You know, it was a program that was funded by the British government, DFID. And, you know, having to sell all these products and working with the communities, it was great. So I did that for 2.5 years. And then after that, I became director of all the country programs. We worked a lot on maternal child health. And still, you know, malaria prevention. And then from there, I decided to, the organization that I work with offered me the opportunity to provide like consulting assistance to other country programs. So I went to Afghanistan, I went to Dominican Republic, all on different things. Some malaria, some maternal child health. So I was able to kind of see different things. And then my last job for them was in Afghanistan, and I was there for maybe a month and a half. And I also, you know, and it was in 2004, which was right in the time they were starting their first general election. And it was my first kind of experience in a country, in a context like that, right? Which was scary, but very also exciting. But you also kind of see as well the downsides of development and how hard it is. You know, they wanted to start this program. They had funding to be able to provide mosquito nets in the malaria endemic area of Afghanistan, but unfortunately it was in the middle of the conflict zone. So ethically, you can't really send people out, like, you know, all these ethical issues arise, like, how do you get mosquito nets to these people? Do you risk your life, you know, or you risk others' lives to get there? Do you throw them out of a, you know, of a plane? And so it was, you know, there was no banking system, bombs everywhere. You know, there was security. Everybody lived on the same compound, right next to the UN offices. You know, and I very good friends who work with Doctors Without Borders, and at that time too, you know, some of their clinics had been bombed and folks had been kidnapped. So it was a very dangerous situation, and I really admire folks, especially the Afghans. A lot of people that I knew that worked with us were people that actually had exiled themselves and came back. You know. And wanted to do something for their country, but it was just, you know, very, very hard. And also those folks that, you know, the deminers, you know, folks that work for the UN and go in and do this job that are just, you can't imagine. I couldn't imagine doing that. Or folks from Doctors Without Borders. So I did, you know, that was one little snippet, you know, a month and a half, but it really kind of also blew your mind. It blows your mind to see, you know, and it makes you feel very, on the one hand, lucky, but also on the one hand, sad, because you see the worst of humanity, but the best of the humanity at the same time. It really is like that, you know, when you see how people have suffered, but then you see how much there is that enthusiasm and that want and that need to be philanthropic and want to help people. So from there, I decided that I wanted to have a completely different shift. I was offered a job. For me, that was like the pinnacle of my career, which was working for the United Nations itself. I was offered a job at the World Health Organization in Geneva in the headquarters, working on issues related to gender, women, and health. So it was very interesting time. So I moved to Geneva. My friends thought I was crazy. They said, you know, you're not a girl for the headquarters. You do programs. You like to be out in the field. But it was just a whole different, you know, world, you know, living in the big bureaucracy, going to Geneva after being in Afghanistan. I mean, it was kind of crazy. Even though I was only in Afghanistan for a month and a half, I mean, it just, Geneva is like, you can't get more civilized than Switzerland, right? So I was in Geneva. I worked for this department, which no longer exists, which is very sad, but it was basically a department that people considered like the crazy feminists, right? And they actually put us in the X building. It literally was called the X building, right? Bâtiment X. Where the idea was that we needed to convince people in public health that gender issues were very important, you know, and there are differences, you know, the way that certain diseases affect men and women differently, you know, how medications affect men and women differently. So there are a lot of things that people don't understand, or the impact of violence, domestic violence, not just physical and road safety, things like that, but violence in the home in particular, how that affects both men and women, but mostly women in particular. But we were still seen within the WHO as kind of the vanguards out there, right? So it was kind of a constant battle to try to explain to people things that they actually, a lot of it that they knew. So, you know, for most of the world, you know, for example, in HIV, the cocktail was a lifesaver, you know, really did kind of change the tide and, you know, slowly converted the disease from something that was acute and fatal to chronic and manageable, although now it's not for everybody. But what they found, though, is that, you know, the failure rate for the cocktail was actually much higher for women at that point. I don't know whether it's changed out because I haven't worked in there for a while, for women than for men, because it was also another big issue is that, you know, when drugs are tested and researched, researchers, and not necessarily they don't do this on purpose, but don't necessarily want a lot of women within the test populations because we have hormonal fluctuations, right? So then, you know, when they decide dosing, they just kind of wing it, right? Or they make an estimation. And a lot of times, physiologically, women, you know, react differently to drugs or, you know, tuberculosis, for example, TB, affects men differently. A lot of gender differences, too, because of sociocultural factors. that you see very clearly in countries like Russia, where the mortality rate, the difference between the average mortality rate of men and women is about 10 years, which is a big, it was then, I haven't checked it now, but it's probably still the same. Women on average tend to live at least 5 years more than men on average, but the difference there was almost double, and it's mostly due to alcoholism, right? So you really do see the effects of that every day. So I was at WHO trying to fight the good fight with all my feminist friends. One of the things that the great accomplishment of that department was that one of the heads researchers had worked on a study for maybe a decade on the impact of violence against women in different countries, I think 25 countries, and they did research interviewing, I think, almost 30,000 women from 25 different sites. And what they found, you know, was, you know, basically reinforce what we had already known, is that, you know, at least one in four women will be exposed to some sort of violence within their home in their lifetime. One in four, one in three, I think it's one in three. And of those, people assume too that, you know, while women are pregnant, that that's a protective time. But what we found is that was a very large percentage of women also were exposed to physical violence while they were pregnant, which is a big shock. You know, you assume that. So it was a great experience working for WHO in that I saw how the bureaucracy and the machine functioned. I made very good friends. I saw how laws were made, right, how policy was made. But I also realized that that wasn't for me. So after a couple of years, I left and I, you know, decided to see. It took me a while to decide what I wanted to do, and I spent a couple of years in Paris. And from there, I started getting offered small, you know, consulting gigs. And the first job I got was through somebody that I knew at WHO that was starting to work in another organization focused on cancer. And they asked me to do a small project for them. And I thought it was fascinating because I'd never worked in cancer before. I'd worked in all of the typical the health and development issues, like I said, AIDS, malaria, TB, maternal child health. But cancer, no. And so it was a whole new sort of challenge for me. And the more I started working with them and the more I researched, I was fascinated because it was really cancer within this world of public health was basically neglected in terms of its impact on low and middle income countries. Because people tend to assume that that cancer really is, you know, when we think about cancer, we think about cancer in our own perspective, right? We see all of the ads. We know that, you know, we have a lot of opportunities here to get very good treatment. People assume that there's a lot of money invested in research, that survival rates are getting better. And it's true, but that's very true in Western countries, United States and Europe. So people automatically assume that it's the same other ways, and it's not. So what you see is that when you talk about health disparities and it, health inequities, you know, there's no better example than cancer. Especially when you know that there are a lot of cancers that are out there that are treatable, curable, that have very good survival rates if they're detected early. So there are a lot of people that are dying of diseases that could be preventable easily and in a very low-tech way. So it was very exciting because UICC, where I have spent a lot of my time now, well, the last 10 years, had really been trying to work with the UN and the international community to really put cancer on the global health agenda, right, where it needed to be. So I had worked a lot in my first couple of years on developing advocacy campaigns in the international, you know, in the global community, trying to explain why we needed to get more funding for ministries of health, for programs on the ground to be able to deal with cancer, to have more trained oncologists, more access to treatment, more access to technologies, prevention, vaccines, particularly with HPV for cervical cancer. So it's been very interesting and it's been very challenging, because the development world and the international community has usually been very, very welcoming of working on issues, you know, the three pandemics, AIDS, TB, and malaria, maternal child health as well. But it's taken them a while to be able to kind of get on the bandwagon and see how important it is, cancer, because, you know, cancer and other NCDs kill more people per year than the three pandemics combined, right? And people don't realize that. And that's not to say that we need to stop working on those other diseases, because we do. We don't. The idea is not to make the pizza short, you know, cut the pizza into smaller slices, but make the pizza larger, right, to be able to really provide for those. And from there, I started working on specific projects in country, on specific cancers, particularly on cancers that affect women, so breasts and cervical. And cervical, for me, is a big issue, and I wish I could talk, you know, shout it out to the world that, you know, it's just so many women die needlessly of a cancer that is completely, cervical cancer is completely preventable, curable, and treatable if caught early. And in a lot of countries, particularly in Central America, it's the number one or number two cause of mortality of cancer for women. And it's very sad because, you know, there are a lot of ways to treat it, and there are a lot of very low-tech ways of treating it. If women had access to proper diagnosis, early detection. And it's very sad because the issue with cervical cancer is that, you know, we take it for granted that, you know, here in the States and Europe, for those who have access to good health care or have access to Planned Parenthoods, for example, we know and we understand the importance of getting your pap smear every few years. Other women around the world don't have that. And then, but the problem is that the cervical cancer and the virus that causes it develops very slowly, right? And you may not have symptoms for years, but by the time that you have symptoms, it's already too late, right? And that's the problem. You know, so it's not that women realize that something's wrong. They basically bleed out, and it's a really horrible sort of way to die. The other issue, too, is pediatric cancer. We've made... Thanks to folks like St. Jude, which is an amazing institution. I mean, and if anyone has ever had the opportunity to go visit St. Jude in Memphis, I mean, it really is its own mini city. And they, not one child is charged or their family. There's some kids there that are there for 3 years. I mean, it's amazing to think, you know, that they're there and they have the access to the best treatment. Thanks to people like St. Jude, the survival rate, average survival rate for kids who have cancer, is about 80%. I think increasing, and I think that and that's average. And some pediatric cancers, I think it's even higher. It's actually the opposite for kids that live in the developing world. So mortality rate for kids who have cancer in poorer countries is 80% plus of cancers that are completely treatable. So, you know, for a child, their survival really depends, really, if they have cancer and where they live in the world and what access they have. And St. Jude is doing a lot to actually help try to close that gap and make sure that we can increase survival rates in these different countries. But, you know, the more that you research and you read and you see, the more I feel very grateful that, you know, I was able to come into cancer, working on cancer prevention and control at a time where it was really starting to gain momentum in the international community. And I could use what I learned from all those different experiences I had working on different diseases to help them kind of start promoting themselves in the international community. And also use that experience to help develop programs in different countries and work with ministries of health and different nonprofits and research institutions to be able to help. So
what are some of the countries that you've been working with? Talk about that so people know.
So I've been working mostly in Central America for the most part, and mm-hmm. South America as well. So El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua. And then in South America, we've been doing some work as well in Paraguay and in Colombia, but for different things. But in terms of cervical cancer, mostly the Americas, Central America. Although cervical cancer in and of itself throughout the Americas, Central and South, is still a big problem. There's some countries are a little more advanced in their treatment with access as well. So you see the mortality rate is a little lower, but it's still very high compared to what we see here. I mean, when you hear of a woman that dies of cervical cancer, it's an anomaly. It's a big deal. Breast cancer as well is another issue for women that, you know, survival rates have gone through the roof thanks to a lot of fundraising that's been done through Komen, Susan G. Komen Foundation, and others, American Cancer Society. People understand now the importance of getting your mammogram and going to get checked and women in other parts of the world don't have that opportunity. You know, mammography machines, for example, or thermography machines, you know, aren't as readily available, or only available in, you know, one or two places. Because it's very rare that you see that people talk about global cancer, right? So I'm still working on those public health issues, and I think that, you know, we have a long way to go. But we're trying to find ways now of not just doing global advocacy, but also actually finding money to be able to work in countries and help them really raise the level of cancer care and training for oncologists and nurses to really make a difference. You know, the other issue too that's a big importance, not just to folks in cancer, but public health at large, is access to palliative care, right? And access just to pain treatment. And it's one of those issues that really does kind of resonate, and people understand that automatically, regardless, right? Here and everywhere else, right? No one should die in pain, right? And most people, unfortunately, die in horrific pain when they don't need to. Morphine is very cheap. It's $1 a dose, along with other opioids. But for a lot of different reasons, either lack of budget, issues with distribution, or legal issues within specific countries, you know, a lot of patients who are experiencing very heavy pain or in their terminal phase really, you know, die in a way that with needless pain. And no one should have that. You know, what I think is important to take away from what I do is the notion that, you know, health is a basic human right. Access to health care for everybody is a basic human right. And throughout my travels, you know, I lived and worked in Europe. I've lived in Eastern Europe. I've lived in Latin America. I've worked in Africa. You see the whole range of what people get their access to treatment, you know, and I saw it even now with the birth of my daughter, who, you know, was premature and was in a neonatal intensive care unit here in one of the best hospitals in the region. When I compare that to what I see the hospitals in other parts of the world, it's, you know, mind-blowing to me. And so inherently unfair, right? That, you know, people around the world don't get the same access that we do. And even in this country, we don't get the same access. And it's been very sad, but also heartening at the same time to see what's going on in the United States right now. And you compare that to what's happening, you know. But what it also shines a light on is the inequality in the access to healthcare, even here in the world's, one of the world's wealthiest countries with the best doctors in the world, right? People don't have access. People are one catastrophic disease away from going completely bankrupt, right? I was very lucky, you know. When my child was born and she had to spend 2 months in the NICU, I had very good insurance, but I knew that it wasn't going to cover all of it. And I just said to myself, well, you know, I'm going to pay it off little by little as much as I could. At least I had a job that would be able to do that. It would take me 30 years, but I'm going to do it. But on the one hand, but the other hand, that made me very sad, because I knew that if I had had my child, for example, in Spain or in England or in Europe, I wouldn't have to worry about it, right? That would be automatically covered. And it should be like that for every child. It should be like that for anybody, you know, who goes through an illness. So, you know, we now see how important it is, health as a basic human right, even here. So hopefully that will also translate for people to be more kind and compassionate and understanding of how important that is to extend that around the world. In the end, we need to treat our folks better, regardless of where they are, whether they are addicted, whether they are born prematurely, whether they have a terminal illness, not just cancer, but something else.
You could have a car accident. Anything can happen.
Right. I mean,
being born is our pre-existing condition.
Right. Exactly.
Because
life just
goes at you from any angle.
And I think that, you know, I am very, very privileged because, like I said, I've seen the best and the worst of humanity. But to be able to have had the opportunity to travel as much as I have, and to work with different people from different cultures, to really work with him, you know, in some cases actually live and breathe and see what it's like. I will never know what it's like, you know, to be somebody that lived, you know, a Romanian at that time, you know, even though I made $150 a month, right? My housing was paid for, I had the Peace Corps, you know, I had an infrastructure. I can't imagine what it was like, you know, for these folks to live off $150 a month, you know, and that was pretty good. You know, can you imagine what it's like in Haiti or the Sudan? Or, and so one of the things you see too is that, you know, people that are heads of ministries, heads of state, particularly heads of ministries, you know, they do the best that they can with the budgets that they have, right? So when you talk about vaccines, you know, we already know that the HPV vaccine really is, you know, hopefully within a couple of generations, that's one cancer that hopefully will be wiped out, and a lot of STDs, because that also kind of helps protect against other sexually transmitted infections for both girls and boys, right? But it was expensive, and, you know, you have to kind of budget and look at the pros and cons of being able to afford that, but also all the regular other immunizations, okay? And you've got to do your childhood vaccines first. Or, you know, how do you prioritize when you have such little dollars? And it's all about, you know, literally, it's trying to prioritize. And, you know, coupled with the fact that a lot of these ministries, you know, do have you know, are inefficient. You know, people need better training. They need better computer systems and better warehousing. And there's corruption, too. I mean, you can't deny that that doesn't exist. But
nonetheless, an organization like UICC comes in and facilitates programs for certain countries.
Right. And so what we try to do is, on the advocacy level, at the global level, we try to explain to people that low and middle income countries really are having a horrible crisis. I mean, it is an exploding pandemic. Cancer and other non-communicable diseases, right? So cancer, cardiovascular, upper respiratory, diabetes are affecting not just, you know, we assume that diabetes and cardiovascular are really diseases of the wealthy. They're no longer, right? Poor diet, nutrition, changes in lifestyle are also affecting a lot of poor countries. And it's very hard because a lot of times these are very chronic diseases, drains the system. But that we don't have enough funding like we did for the Global Fund. You know, there was a fund that was specifically established to the tune of billions of dollars that work primarily in poorer countries to help improve access to medications and treatments for the three AIDS, TB, and malaria. But we don't have something similar for cancer or other non-communicables. So that's the next frontier, is to be able to make sure that there is a fund established so that each of these countries are able to really treat, to really pinpoint and provide the best care possible for their communities, for their citizens. And hopefully, you know, in my own little part, we've helped convince people little by little. I mean, this is, it's, you know, it's yeoman's work, you know, but I love it. I love it. And it's hard. And, you know, when you work, the other great thing about working at public health is that, especially when you work with doctors, clinicians, researchers, nurses on the front line, you know, we talk a lot about doctors, but really it's a lot of times nurses are the first ones and the ones that really, and I know, you know, for personal experience, the nurses in my NICU, I can't thank them enough. All those folks need our help, you know, need our support. And, you know, if you decide, anyone who decides to work in public health, particularly those that work in poor countries where they have such limited access, they have such big hearts, you know, they want to be able to do things with very, very limited, very little money. And I'll be honest, I've met very few people in the, you know, in the oncology world that aren't, you know, just big-hearted and really philanthropic and wanting to help people, particularly the pediatric oncologists. You know, folks who decide to work with kids with cancer are very, very special, really, because it really does take a special type of person. And folks who do hospice and palliative care too, not just with cancer, but with all patients, you know, they're God's gift. You know, there are not a lot of people that are able to face that, you know, and help people make that transition. You know, and it's also to give them that solace, you know, for them, for their final days. I don't think I could do it. I don't think I would have that fortitude to do that. So we're very blessed that those people exist every day.